Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 22nd of April 2018. My name's T.R.P. Watson, and this time I'm joined by Johnny Fox, Paul in London, and Gareth James. We're now going to talk about The Country Wife at the Southwark Playhouse. This is a production of William Wycherley's Restoration Comedy. It's directed here by Luke Roberts, with a set and costume design by Stuart Charlesworth. This is a production presented by the company Morphic Graffiti. Stars Daniel Crane, Mabel Clements, Richard Clues, Eddie Eyre, Sam Graham, Siobhan Harrison, Joshua Hill, Sarah Lamb, Leo Starr and Nancy Sullivan. The idea of the play is that a young man called Horner has told the world via his tame doctor that he is impotent, and he is therefore able to mix in company with all the wives of the town, perhaps including the country wife of his old friend and sparring partner Pinchwife, who has married a young innocent woman and has mistakenly brought her to the city and wants to keep her innocent. This is fairly typical of the plays of the early Restoration, where we have a lot more talking and thinking about sex and a lot more sex going on in very close proximity to the stage, which is slightly different from when William and Mary come to the throne, when Restoration comedy becomes a lot more innocent, as we say, or a lot more puritanical, because we're getting a good dose of Dutch Puritanism into the theatre and into the way the world worked. Unlike The Way of the World, which we talked about the other week, this play has been given a 1920s setting, which is in a way suitable because it's the first time almost since the Restoration that Britain opened up sexually. Obviously there was a period in sort of the late Georgian times and Regency times when Britain became a little bit more interesting from that point of view, but really the 1920s is another period where women can become more liberated and men can be thought of as having sex without there being too much of a problem with it. I mean, we get things like Mary Stopes publishing Married Love and things like that. So I thought of a very interesting way of putting the play into a new perspective and updating the play. It's not something you could remodel into, say, a Victorian world. It has to be in this relatively narrow time. I mean, you'd have to set it in another country in order to set it at another time other than, of course, the Restoration. What did you think about this production, John?
I suppose it's a bit of declaration of interest first, because I have history with The Country Wife. When I was a drama student, I learned the role of Harcourt in 24 hours when illness devastated the company at the Nuffield Theatre, Lancaster. So I had a lot of fun in the play, even though I was very nervous. But the reviewer from The Guardian only stayed till the interval. And because I had an awful lot more to do in the first half than the second, hailed me as both the star and the saviour of the show, which didn't really make me very popular with the actual leads, who were only mentioned in sort of the final sentence. So I like The Country Wife. I obviously know it quite well. And piece written in 1675 by Wycherley. So we're sort of 70 to 80 years after the peak of Shakespeare. It's bold and it's direct and it satirizes marriage in the style of Molière, by whom Wycherley was very much influenced. He did translate a lot of Molière for the British stage. And effectively, all men are philanderers and all women are expected to be faithful. It's, you know, that sort of hypocrisy that we still haven't really quite got past. So as you say, the plot is enormous fun. You're the randiest git in London. And in order to negotiate access to some of the most attractive and wealthy women, you spread the rumour you're completely impotent so that their husbands trust the wives in your company. And in turn, the wives queue up to ride you to exhaustion, but still return to the husbands who control the purse strings. Nearly 400 years later, not a lot's changed. So people have a lot of license to reinterpret Shakespeare as they wish. And I couldn't think of another version of a Restoration comedy that I'd seen so updated into another. I've seen completely modern versions of them, but never something that was just updated into another popular era, if you like. So it's quite interesting that Morphic Graffiti chose the 20s. It is, as you say, a time of, well, it was before actual female emancipation. Women didn't get the vote until about 1935, did they? But it's a time of female opportunity. As you say, Mary Stopes had just published her book, so women were able to take a little bit more control over their own bodies and activities. And I liked how Morphic Graffiti had applied this layer of the Jazz Age onto the sort of debauchery of The Country Wife. you mentioned the two guys who are morphic graffiti. Luke Fredericks is the director, Stuart Charlesworth is the designer, and they are the partners in the venture. And between them, they have dressed, or you could really say undressed, this production with really buff bodies, lush costumes, and these fantastic jazz dance scene changes to ragtime versions of contemporary pop. And I thought that was wonderful. I thought in a way, in the scene changes, it looked like Pippin hadn't quite shipped out, because people are still sort of posing and throwing shapes and dancing around in the shadows. But it is possibly a criticism of a production if the thing you enjoy most is the scene changes. The other thing I enjoyed a lot was the super busy lighting plot by a young lighting designer who I think has a great future, a young man called Sam Waddington. And every third funny line, if you like, is pointed with a lighting change. And there are over 300 cues in this lighting plot, which is really an awful lot and quite a challenge to the apparatus that's up there at Southwark. So cutting and pasting of this very wordy script and pointing every third laugh line with a lighting change has the effect of not shortening The Country Wife by very much, and it is a very long play. But it did shift the focus for me away from maybe Horner and his whoring and the romance between Harcourt and Alethea. And you get new highlights, which are very good as well, including Daniel Kane, who I thought was absolutely riotous as the witless fop Sparkish. And something that they introduce a couple of set pieces at the end of each act, but there's a kind of When Harry Met Sally solo moment to an opera track for Sarah Lamb playing Lady Fidget, which, you know, definitely brings Act One to a climax. Whether I thought everybody was rightly cast or delivering a consistent performance is a bit harder to pinpoint. I was disappointed with Nancy Sullivan as Marjorie, who plays the country wife, the title role. In the original script, she's a kind of Ambridge sort of innocent who develops her awareness during the course of the action. And I think she really felt more like an Essex girl who was already pretty wily and knew what was what than the character needed. So she doesn't provide the counterpoint to the sort of city-dwelling debauchery and hypocrisy that Wycherley was aiming to satirise. So I think it makes for a lovely, lively 1920s farce, and I think it's delivered with a lot of style and a lot of class. But maybe it robbed the original of some of its actually shocking impact. And if the production had any kind of feminist point to make, I think it was lost under the welter of costumes and pantomime. And, you know, bad pun, but lots of rakes, but not much progress.
I had quite a lot of fun with this. And in fact, I slightly preferred this to The Way of the World, which I saw about a week later. I liked it. I did think they had trimmed it a little bit. It didn't feel quite as long as The Way of the World did. The Way of the World felt very long and an awful lot of explaining. They seemed to get the plot together and move it forward quite well. And if they did make it long, it's long because of bits in the scene changes and things like that, which I thought were very well done. I enjoyed the music and the, as you say, the lighting is very effective. I had a lot of fun with this. I've had bad luck with previous versions of this play. I've not really had an awful lot of fun. I saw a rather disappointing production of it years ago at the Mermaid Theatre, which starred Fenella Fielding and should have starred Peter Wingard, but he was off, and also John Mulder Brown as Horner. I found that one rather disappointing. I was also disappointed with Jonathan Kent's version that was done in 2007 at the Theatre Royal Haymarket, which had Toby Stevens and Patricia Hodge and a number of other, you know, very interesting people. I mean, David Haig as Pinchwife. That I didn't think worked at all. And I was very happy that this one actually worked and this one actually brought out the fun of the play. I will say that women were given the vote in 1918, although I think it's women over a certain age, not all women. Full franchise, as you say, didn't come out until in the 1930s, so the women were fully enfranchised. I thought it was a very good way of putting it into a different setting, which I thought worked very well. But they didn't go down the Jeeves and Worcester route, which I think you thought you would. So, yeah, I like this. The other people who've reviewed it have found it rather lackluster and a bit dull. But I didn't find that. I did find it rather entertaining.
It's not dull. I think if you want dull, you need to go and see it at the Minerva Theatre in Chichester in June, when I think they'll do it much more straight.
We're now going to talk about Twang at the Union Theatre. This is Lionel Bart's 1965 musical, which had a rather fraught production history early on. Apparently, when they were workshopping this, people's parts would disappear if they went for a toilet break. And it is supposed to be a spoof on the character of Robin Hood, but it didn't work originally. It's directed here by Brian Hodgson, with choreography by Mitchell Harper and music direction by Henry Brennan. Now, in 2008, the book was redone by Julian Wolford, and I think that's the version that they are now licensed to do via the company that controls the musical. But it was very disastrous at the time. I think it did 43 performances, and is said to have cost Lionel Bart his fortune. Paul, tell me about this production at the Union and what you thought of it.
Thanks, Tim. Well, actually, as I was watching it, I was thinking, well, this seems like a much more straightforward story than what, having not seen any previous versions of this show, but what it's been purported the previous version to have been. So in some ways, I was kind of thinking, oh, it would have been fun to have seen that, at least from a musical theatre aficionado or musical theatre history point of view, because apparently it really was a disaster and barely run. It was one of the more notorious flops of its time, and also cost Lionel Bart, or one of the reasons why Lionel Bart lost his fortune. So yeah, as you mentioned, about 10 years ago, they decided to rewrite the book. And it seems like very little of the plot, although it didn't sound like much of the plot was there in the first place, has been jettisoned in favor of a story about Robin Hood having lost his twang, which I think then neatly ties into the title of the show. So basically, all his merry men are usually the ones that are helping him get out of various mess, because he's somehow lost his middle age equivalent of mojo and has not found a way of getting it back. And alongside that, there is a story about Much, who is the miller's son. He's run away from home and who's rescued by Robin Hood and his merry men. And he wanted to actually live in Sherwood Forest, only to find that life there is a bit like living in a musical comedy, and he hates musical comedies. So then Q, and pretty much throughout the show, so many musical theatre references that you'd probably have to be a student of musical theatre to get them all, although most are quite obvious. And basically the musical revolves around how to get Robin's twang back, but also how to get Much falling in love and paired up with Delphina, who's one of the ladies-in-waiting for Maid Marian. It's rather a silly story, to be fair, but it's mostly harmless, I think, would be the takeaway from this. With the youthful cast they've sort of assembled for this production, I think, you know, they give it so much energy and enthusiasm, it's hard not to like this. Probably the choice of casting was making me think that maybe this is a show that would play very well as a high school musical, but it'll be interesting if Gareth thinks the same. But you know, I guess the best thing about this is that they've resurrected a lost Lionel Bart show. And while his music may not be, you know, as memorable as some of his other works, it's still actually, you know, part of Lionel Bart's work. And it was great to see that it's now available for people to see, having been lost for so many years. Gareth, what did you think?
Well, I had a good time, and to be frank, I wasn't really expecting to have a good time, because when you do read about the history of the show, and then I didn't read any reviews. You can't help seeing the stars as you're passing, as it were. My expectations were lowered, really. I think the history is really interesting, because in the 5 years up to this, he'd had four pretty big hits, really. His first show as composer and lyricist, Things Ain't What They Used To Be. Then he had his huge hit, of course, Oliver. Then he had Blitz. And then he had Maggie May. And all of those ran for over a year. So, you know, they're all pretty successful. So then along comes this. And I think you can probably put it down to, well, he had a big drink habit. But he also was apparently by then taking LSD as well, which, when you've seen the show, doesn't surprise you. So I suspect it's just his, you know, the state he was in. It was a troubled show because the writer was troubled. And his friend and mentor, Joan Littlewood, who was meant to direct it, walked out, as indeed other people walked out. They brought in Bert Shevelov to try and help. He's the man who wrote the book for Sondheim's A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, which was around about the same time. But he couldn't rescue it. And apparently the opening night was a complete and utter fiasco. So it was a critical and a commercial flop. It did close early. The funny thing about it closing early, I think, is that one of its stars was Ronnie Corbett. And because it closed early, he was able to take another job And that other job turned out to be the Frost Report. So it also contributes to the history of TV comedy as well. The other people in the show, incidentally, include Barbara Windsor, and that wouldn't surprise you, Bernard Breslau, and a singer, a 60s singer called Long John Baldry. So it's certainly a fascinating history. The new book was commissioned by Bart's estate, and it was the Guildford School of Acting's Julie Wolford, who's, I think, their musical theatre chap, who wrote it. And it also says in the programme the music has been adapted by Richard John, but I don't really know what adapted means. To be honest, I'm not sure the new book's done, because I haven't seen the show before, really. But it is basically just an innuendo-laden romp and a bit of a panto. I don't think the book has sort of breathed new life into the story. But I do think that what it's done for a show that was meant to be a spoof on Robin Hood, it's now a spoof on Robin Hood that's sending up musical theatre as a form. Because as Paul said, it's littered with references to musical theatre. And there's also something else in it which fascinated me, which there's a running joke about a character who's called Alan a Dale, who's trying to write a song. And in Tim Rice's Blondel, or Tim Rice and Stephen Oliver's Blondel, there is also a running joke about a man who's trying to write a song, the Blondel character. And of course, that musical takes place at exactly the same time, except that Richard's off in the Crusades and his brother's here with Robin Hood. I just thought that was quite a fun kind of coincidence. And the song he is writing in this version of the show is actually Living Doll, Cliff Richard's Living Doll, which of course was one of Bart's songs. So I quite like that extra bit as well, really. I thought, and I hope, the choreography was quite tongue-in-cheek because it featured an awful lot of jazz hands. And I felt the show was kind of, in a way, sending itself up. And like Paul, whatever you think of the material, you have to admire this young, energetic, enthusiastic cast, because they just give it everything. And at the end of the day, you are kind of swept away by that. And I surprised myself at the end of the evening by actually applauding loudly and going away thinking, well, that was fun. So infectious fun. Anybody who's really interested in musical theatre, because Lionel Bart, I think, is a very important person in musical theatre, certainly in Britain, it'd be worth going to see it. And anybody who just wants a sort of harmless bit of Carry On up the Union probably would enjoy it as well, really. But it's I thought it was good fun, and I was frankly glad I went.
We're now going to talk about Instructions for Correct Assembly by Thomas Eccleshare. This play is directed by Hamish Pirrie at the Royal Court Downstairs and designed by Kai Difan. It stars Michelle Austin, Justin Barnett, Mark Bonner, Jane Horrocks, Shaniqua Okwok, and Brian Vernal. The plot is that a couple who have lost their son decide that they can sort of build another version of him and see if they can get parenting right this time. Gareth, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Well, it centres around a couple, Harry and Max, Max being a woman. And Harry clearly likes to tinker his sort of shed, and he sort of considers himself to be really good with things that come as flatbacks, as it were. And the beginning of the play, we see them acquiring various things and assembling them, you know, mostly small projects. And then quite soon they graduate to a rather big project, which is to build themselves a person called Jan. And from here on, we kind of begin to understand that actually they've lost their son, Nick. And what they're building is effectively a replacement son, Jan. And then we have the two stories, the story of Nick and his life and what happened to him, with the story of Jan's development. And they kind of interweave with one another. And the only other characters are some neighbours, which is a couple and their daughter. And we see the other neighbours. And in fact, Jan begins to malfunction. And that actually brings consequences, because it does cause quite a bit of chaos and damages the relationships with these neighbours. And along the way, we see how parents are kind of moulding their children, both the neighbours and this couple. And we also see how they're instilling values and attitudes in them, and also how helpless parents can be when the children grow up. The downside of the play is that it's 100 minutes long, but there are something like 50 scenes. So it, you know, there is an awful lot of change. However, I did find I got into the rhythm of the scene changes. I mean, some of the scenes are really, really short, you know, seconds rather than minutes. And I did find I got into the rhythm of them, because the props arrive and leave on conveyors. And with some of the scene changes, the members of the cast kind of move robotically and sort of jump around. And indeed, the space changes shape from a small cinema screen-like space, and then it sort of enlarges and opens up quite a lot and comes back again as well. So I found that was kind of occupying my time. But I do think it's a bit staccato as a result of having all of those scenes, and I think it does damage us a little bit. But it did make me think. I mean, it made me think about the use and abuse of technology. It made me think about parent-child relationships, and probably what it's about more than anything else is grief. It did make me think quite a lot, and it is extremely well executed. You know, the design, as you say, by Kai Dovan, I thought was exceptional. And I thought that the performances are very good. I mean, I have to single out Brian Vernal, who plays both Jan and Nick. And he has to switch not only sort of between characters, but he has to switch within characters. And I thought he was extremely impressive. And I know that was an exceptional performance, really. I'd heard some negative stuff before I went, but I rather liked it. And it's, you know, it had its faults, particularly in this kind of staccato bit. But I did leave the theatre thinking, well, that was pretty thought-provoking, that was quite intriguing, that was pretty original. So I was glad I went, which isn't always the way I come out to the Royal Court. I sense you might not be quite so positive, Tim.
I didn't hate this, but there was things about it I really didn't get on with. I mean, and I'm rather surprised at all the sort of the 4- and 5-star reviews it seems to have got from various people, because I didn't think it was that impressive. I got very depressed at one point when you had the women doing the washing up, and I thought, sorry, am I watching an episode of Terry and June here? There is that kind of idea, and it doesn't feel particularly satirical in what they're doing in that part of it. And I thought, in the end, it's a little bit overlong, and I think that judicious bit of cutting, and possibly cutting maybe 20 minutes or half an hour out of it, and also putting it upstairs where you don't have to have quite the production values, because you don't need all the fussiness. I found that you know, quite a lot of the set stuff was very fussy, and if you'd done it upstairs, you wouldn't have been able to do that, and then it would have worked a lot better. It's that kind of thought-provoking play you often get upstairs, but it needed to be a lot more concentrated. They need to have a better idea of what they were doing. I found you didn't really believe them as parents, and it felt an awful lot like pastiches of parents or parodies of parents without any parodic force, without trying to spear anything. He's just playing with old cliches, which are nothing new. You know, in the end, the story of Brian Vernal's character, Nick, his story is interesting, but it doesn't really get you anywhere. It needed to concentrate on the important things in this story rather than it's a little bit flabby and a little bit too conventional and reliant on cliches in the bits that aren't the really interesting parts, you know, like the idea of how they're getting their robot wrong and also the story of Nick. I felt that they were wasting the additional characters, you know, the family of the neighbours. They're just shown to be kind of perfect and a bit pushy and okay, but give me more character, tell me a little bit more about their story, and tell me a little bit more about Nick, and also how they're breaking Jan. And really, you know, I'm not going to give away the ending, but I really didn't understand what the point of that was. It was just a bit silly, really. So, you know, I could see that there's lots of quality in there, and certainly the quality of the acting. I'm never going to complain about seeing people like Michelle Austin or Mark Bonner or Jane Horrocks or anything, and Brian Vernal is going up and up in my estimation. So I was very pleased to see this cast assembled, and I think perhaps because I thought it was such a good cast, I was more disappointed that, you know, people were not being given anything to do, and you weren't really getting deep characters. You know, they're almost caricatures of parents, so there's nothing really deep about them. They're all this kind of sunny people without any depth to them. And it annoyed me that the I could see that there was something there, but I didn't think it was good enough to be downstairs at the Royal Court, you know, which is a rather prestige place, and it might work better upstairs. I can't quite understand why people are so happy with this and so satisfied with this when I was really rather disappointed with it. But it's not that it's a terrible play or that, you know, it's awful or badly acted, because it isn't. It's very well acted, but it's just, I think I expected a lot more and I didn't get it.
I don't think they could do it upstairs. I mean, I think because of the set changes and scene changes, I think it'd be very hard to do it in the theatre upstairs. And in any event, I think it actually benefits from the size of the stage because of this kind of, you know, the way it can open up and change. Others have said the same as you about the ending, and the friend I went with said the same thing about the ending. But I felt the point of the ending was that they'd now moved on to another sort of fad or another thing to occupy themselves in their grief. And that was how I read the ending, really. You know, they were now becoming gym people or whatever. But anyway, I haven't seen any 5-star reviews. I've seen some 4 stars, but mostly 3 stars. And I'm hovering between the 3 and the 4, really. That's where I'm at. So I enjoyed it more than you. I wouldn't rave about it, but I would recommend it, I think.
The point about it being upstairs instead of downstairs is that if it's upstairs, then they would have to concentrate on sharpening it up and making sure that they're not having to do the constant scene changes, that you have to exist on a much sort of smaller technical budget, so you have to make the technology, the techniques that you do count, and you put the space in their imagination. I don't think that, even though you get different props coming on, you don't feel that it differentiates the actual space. They just felt like backdrops. They didn't feel like fully realized spaces, you know, such as a kitchen or a living room or a garage. They didn't feel like that, because it's this idea of the conveyor belt just bringing on the props. It never felt that it was real, or that they didn't have a sense of reality about that. And okay, if it's not real, then you don't need all the trappings.
But I eventually came to the conclusion that the number of scenes and the shortness of the scenes was part of the point of the play. So I actually don't think that they could change the number of scenes without fundamentally changing the play. I think it would be a different play, because I think the point of it is the number of scenes and how it hops around and how it sort of eventually fits together. But anyway, there we are.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the Assetto named London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.